You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Neil for the past 2 hours of Too Good to Be Forgotten. But now at 12 p.m, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly look at the latest film releases screening across Cambridge and beyond. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show this afternoon are Steph Smith.
Hello.
Gavin Midgley.
Hello.
Mark Livesich.
Good afternoon.
And new recruit Jack Toy.
Hello.
Today's show is an all-review affair with a collection of new releases that leap from speculative fiction to superhero antics by way of two marriages in crisis and the reckless abandon of youth. Johnny Depp is a scientist whose disembodied brain becomes the harbinger for a new world order in the science fiction thriller Transcendence. We've the very finest teenage rebellion in We Are the Best as three young girls form a punk band to shake up 1980s Stockholm. We've different but equally experimental views of marriage in a confined space with Joanna Hogg's Housebound exhibition and the nighttime drive of Steve Knight's Lock. And the springtime of superheroes continues with The Amazing Spider-Man 2, with old Webhead, played by Andrew Garfield, up against both Matters of the Heart and the crazy villainry of Jamie Foxx's Electro. But we begin the show by turning it off and on again.
The path to building superintelligence requires us to unlock the most fundamental secrets of the universe. Once online, its analytical power will be greater than the collective intelligence of every person born in the history of the world.
What did you do?
Take out the cores.
Revolutionary independence from technology, Rift.
They hit AI labs all over the country.
They're determined to stop any attempt at what you call transcendence.
We're looking at 5 weeks before a system shuts down.
When I'm gone, keep moving forward.
I won't let you go.
We can upload his consciousness.
We can save him.
Oh my God.
It's like my mind has been set free. I'm gonna need to expand. I need more power. Get me online.
This is no well.
Shut it down.
Shut it down? It's him!
Where are you going?
Everywhere.
As is the custom, now that summer has rolled around, Hollywood is turning its thoughts towards dramatic ways to end the world. Over the next few months, films will besiege us with the usual culprits of malevolent aliens, warring robots, and radioactive lizards. But the first apocalypse of the season comes with the cold computer logic of new release Transcendence. Directed by Wally Pfister, for many years the Christopher Nolan cinematographer, he did Inception and the Batman trilogy, Transcendence is an unfashionably low-key warning about the dangers of technology. An unusually subdued Johnny Depp plays Dr. Will Caster, a brilliant scientist whose experiments in artificial intelligence are breaking new ground. These experiments, conducted alongside his wife Evelyn, played by Rebecca Hall, are on the cusp of creating sentient technology. But this new perfect future isn't everybody's dream, and after an attack by a Luddite terrorist group, Dr. Caster is left mortally wounded by an irradiated bullet. With her husband's death a certainty, Evelyn decides upon a radical idea to keep his brilliant brain alive. Gavin, it's unusual to be offered a science fiction that places word above action. But does Transcendence have the script to match its lofty intentions?
Sadly, no. No, it really doesn't. I mean, there's a lot wrong with the film, but the script is the obvious starting point, I think. It tries to say something interesting or something meaningful about the idea that artificial intelligence is now getting out of control. And, you know, Johnny Depp asks at the beginning of the film, you know, is there a soul to artificial intelligence? And if so, where does this soul reside? And then it sort of does nothing with these questions. All it does is it turns into a sort of either an early 90s sort of paranoid thriller about the internet, things like Johnny Mnemonic and The Net that we had, you know, when the internet was cool and new and trendy and slightly exciting and not the sort of thing we take for granted these days. Or actually it becomes a sort of 1950s B movie, which, you know, purports, well, it actually becomes this sort of terrible warning about technology, you know, becomes so sort of antiquated. It feels so antiquated as you're watching it. As I was watching it, I kept thinking back to Her, which only came out a couple of months ago.
Same studio as well.
Had so much more. It had so much more relevance. So many more interesting things. Even if it didn't completely succeed, it felt like a much more interesting take on a similar idea on the role technology plays in our lives and where it might go. This just feels like a really old-fashioned, script that was dusted off from 1992 and sort of given to a cast who deserve way, way better than this.
Let's talk about that cast and bring them in. Steph, it features a fantastic cast. John Depp's really barely in it. He's more sort of a warm voice than anything else, but Rebecca Hall, Paul Bettany, and Morgan Freeman playing Morgan Freeman, and which is wonderful. So but it's one of those films, one of those stories that relies on intelligent characters consistently doing stupid things. There's no internal logic to the script at all.
I think there's a certain amount of logic to it, but it's very shallow. It doesn't explore any of the issues. As Gavin said, it sort of tiptoes around some issues that it brings up, but doesn't actually deal with them. And I think if you're going to make a film that at its heart has technology, you've got to understand that technology. And if you've got a film that at its heart is supposed to be a strong drama, you've got to be able to create and write characters. And I don't think this film did either. There were a lot of the characters had to undergo quite large arcs during the film. And while I thought particularly Rebecca Hall acted her heart out, she didn't really have the material to be able to be particularly believable in anything she was doing.
I bring Mark here. Are we missing something here? Because I think it is a pretty dreadful film. One of the worst mainstream blockbusters I can remember in some time. But there's a sort of a kernel of an interesting idea here in that it's really a story about a marriage. We've got lots of films on the programme today that are stories of a marriage, and this is another story of a marriage. But that sort of gets lost, but it's a little bit more affecting when you look back on it, perhaps. Does it have an interesting story, but the film's taken completely the wrong approach to telling it?
It's difficult to know quite what they were after, having actually seen the film. There's no chemistry of any real kind between Johnny Depp and Rebecca Hall.
They don't give it time to develop.
No. Better material and actresses and actors those good could have invested believability into that relationship. The material itself is just dreadful. It's basically got two reasonably well-worn science fiction ideas at its core as a script. It never gets the characters to engage with those ideas. It never does anything interesting with those ideas. Those ideas have been played out in mainstream science fiction from Star Trek to Doctor Who to literature to comic books ad nauseum over the past 20, 30 years. It doesn't know if it's trying to be a science fiction film. It doesn't know if it's trying to be a drama. It ends up being a giant, crushing, soul-destroying bore.
Is part of the reason here, Gavin, is that whilst there's a change towards the pulp towards the end, as you said, it's a film of two halves, really, it takes itself so seriously. I'm all for sincerity and seriousness in delivery. I don't want everything to have a wink to the audience like James Bond or Transformers, but this film seems to believe it's a textbook brought to life. But it's just, I think that's its major anchor, is the fact that it's so po-faced about everything.
Yeah, it is. You're waiting for the film to slow down at some point, as if, you know, you're waiting for some moment of characterization. You're waiting to start to believe in these characters and what they're working on and what they're doing. But it never does. It never pauses. It just sort of shuffles quickly on to the next interesting bit of gobbledygook or the next action scene. And it delivers them with the weight that Christopher Nolan tries to deliver. It does feel sort of Christopher Nolan-esque in a way, in the way that it shoots the action, as you would expect, of course, and the use of music. But it never adds anything to that. It feels like someone watched a Christopher Nolan film and then tried to imitate it. I mean, that's the sort of sense I got as I was watching it. I never engaged with anyone at all, and I never believed for a moment that these were actual scientists on screen, and ever who I don't think they ever actually sat in front of a computer, to be honest.
No, that's
my sense of it. It's
a sort of movie scientists where they have to creasingly say stupid things, or when Rebecca Hall, when they realise that Johnny Depp's character is going to die and he's in this extremely advanced hospital where they're looking after him, and she decides, oh, we're going to, you know, plug things into his brain and take his brain out and put it into this computer, which is like some sort of thing that Fu Manchu would have come up with. And then they do it in a warehouse. And yeah. This is childish. There must have been some... why wasn't there? At some stage, somebody just stood up and said, hold on, this looks silly.
Yeah, and anyone who thinks Morgan Freeman is one of the greatest technological minds of our generation, you know, clearly hasn't thought about it at any point in the script making process. What really irritated me was the Johnny Depp, you know, with all the sort of wires coming out of his head at some point, and then Cillian Murphy comes along saying the only way to sort of shut him down is to close down the internet, you know, write a virus and close down the internet. And these are awful, awful script shortcuts have been used over and over again, as Mark said, ad nauseum. These are awful conventions that you just go, oh no, not again, not, someone's actually dared to write in a script, oh, I'm going to write a virus to shut down the internet, you know, and no one apparently has ever thought of telephones being able to work pre-internet age or anything like that, you know.
It's not far off typing Google into Google is their solution. It's that level of
deeply frustrating watch. It really was.
Jen Barber understanding. Sorry.
In fairness, there are some brand new moments of stupidity to go along with all the old cliches. For example, at one point, Rebecca Hall's character checks into a hotel under the pseudonym of Turing. Mm. If you don't know what the Turing test is, I'm sure you can Google it, but it's basically, could a computer deceive itself? And the intent is the computer Johnny Depp gets loaded into is set up early on as being self-aware, yet it talks like it's impersonating the computer from War Games. My phone would have more chance of passing the Turing test than that computer. It just doesn't think about anything it's doing and just hopes you won't notice.
It's made me angry. It has absolutely no understanding of technology. I'm not a technophile, but it has that sort of relationship with technology that 1960s Hollywood had with rock and roll.
Yes.
That we don't quite understand this, let's try to be with the kids. And it's a bit embarrassing.
And again, the classic mistake of calling the computer an acronym that features the words neural network with a clear demonstration of not understanding what a neural network is.
Should it have been, again, we make it sound like we're a bunch of computer geeks complaining that the computer technology is not correct in this film, Steph, but... Maybe it should have been a little bit more procedural, a little bit more genuine science would have made the rest of the story more believable, more interesting, rather than this sort of... Because in the end, this is no more believable than Transformers.
No, and it doesn't have loud crashing robots, but yeah, you're right, the technology was wrong. It wasn't believable, and none of the characters' reactions were believable either. And that's to me is where it falls. It had all these ideas, and it wasn't willing to cut any of them. It had to have this in and that in and that in. And if you'd actually taken half of the ideas and maybe explored them with a little bit more depth, maybe had a couple of scientists look them over and go, maybe you want to do that slightly differently. And maybe looked at the idea of Johnny Depp, once you've digitised him, once he's no longer in a human body, once he's in a computer and he has a different environment to explore, they talk about it a couple of times, you know, he's no longer human. And kind of, well, that's an interesting concept. You can play with that. You can have a bit of fun. What has he turned into? He's now in this computer, and they touch on it, but they don't.
But then it's a slight spoiler here. The twist in the film is that he is almost human. He hasn't changed at all. All the way through the film, people are terrified that he's going to become, as Paul Bettany says at the beginning, if we just miss one memory, what does he become? It becomes Colossus, the Forbin Project.
Yeah.
They didn't miss anything. He does everything he does because he loves his wife. It's only seems awful because of Rebecca Hall's speech at the very beginning when she wants to repair everything. He's just doing her bidding. And that's why I think there's a tiny little... love story that's quite affecting, struggling in this mire of nonsensical science fiction.
That's just one of the many, many stories that's trying to get out. And the love story I would certainly want to keep. But also, going back to the idea of is he still human at the end, my answer is no. But I think what they could have explored is it possible for something that's no longer human to have humanity? the actual core moral beliefs that we have, the way we relate to other people, the idea of the value of life, of human life. You know, would something that's no longer human keep those things? Could something that's no longer human keep those things? I think that could have been fascinating to explore, and they danced close to it. They never actually got there, and that to me is why it was so disappointing, is that it did actually set some really, really high targets and then not go for them.
The show no interest in going for them. Put them on the horizon and then didn't, and then stay, and then eventually it became a silly little chase thriller for about 5 minutes.
It's almost like there's a 6-hour edit waiting to come out, or you cut half the material and make a 2-hour, 3-hour film that actually does explore those things.
I hope there's not a 6-hour edit. is the fault of this film, because it's Wally Pfister's first time behind in the director's chair, does the fault lie with him entirely, or is it? I mean, there's a problematic script here, but could have a director handled the script with more confidence? Is it all down to Jack Paglen's script? It's his debut script, after all.
I think you have to put the fault of this squarely at the door of the studio, because they've given a ridiculous amount of money to an untested director and basically just, you know, given him the same brief as Christopher Nolan, that they trust him to go and do what he wants. Christopher Nolan ultimately proved himself with a series of generally perceived quality films by the time he started getting given these kind of budgets for the Batman films. Wally Pfister has done the cinematography for those films. He has no record as a director to base this on, and ultimately all this proves is that skill in one field in filmmaking doesn't by any means guarantee skill in any others. But ultimately, the studio are the ones that put a giant pocket of money in his lap and let him make this mess.
Though again, on the other side of the coin, at least they put it in the lap of somebody who wanted to make an intellectual science fiction film and didn't want to make a typical action blockbuster.
I have no evidence of that, having actually seen the film.
God.
I'm sorry. I have no evidence of any ambition or any pretense that actually were aiming
moments,
for anything.
There are a few moments where it sort of tries to reach for Terrence Malick style beauty. You know, the way it looks at nature and the interaction of technology with nature. Those are the few moments where I could see him trying to reach for, to say something poetic, if not necessarily deeply intelligent or anything like that. He's actually trying to make something that's interesting in an artistic style. But beyond that, as you said, but that would obviously come from his skills as a cinematographer. Beyond that, he's out of his depth, and it feels like it.
It reminded me a little bit of sixth form poetry. It had that sort of sense of depth, but absolutely no ability to form it or shape it into anything coherent. Okay, well, Transcendence opened yesterday in a screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a Certificate 12A. The recent show of strength by the UK film industry has had a reassuring experimental glow. Under the Skin, Ditch Story for Mood, Lock, which we'll be reviewing shortly, finds its thrills in a single restrictive location, whilst Joanna Hogg's exhibition, released yesterday, continues the director's interest in shrinking cinema to a careful chamber piece. Exhibition stars non-actors Vivian Albertine and Liam Gillick as artists only ever named with the initials of D and H. Together for 20 years, their entire childless marriage has been conducted in the same rambling London house, a modernist structure furnished with Eames chairs and accessorised with clinical sliding doors and office-to-office intercoms. H sits at his desk, his mysterious artwork unfolding on a computer screen, while D drifts about the house brainstorming her performance art. But when H suddenly announces they should sell the house, before it's too late, is his ambiguous excuse, H finds her comfortable, reassuring and inspiring world suddenly in danger of vanishing.
Hi.
Hi. What are you doing?
Just working.
How long have you lived here, do you mind me asking?
18 years, I suppose. Now.
It feels 17. Like 40 or something.
I really love the house still.
We've been here so long.
Sorry, I don't mean that. It's not really a family home, is it? It's an artist's home, and that's what it's...
Well, they are artists. I mean,
yes,
they belong
exactly.
there.
Yes, exactly, so it suits them, but it wouldn't be right for us.
I
couldn't stand it any longer, get them going on about their children all the time. I just wanted to get home.
An exhibition?
Mm.
Excellent.
Mark, from one angle, I suppose Exhibition could be seen as an austere art film, but I found it an affecting emotional drama. How did you respond to it?
I really liked it. I was quite surprised by how many different things it had to say and how well it actually constructed them. It feels like there's commentary on modern marriage, on modern life, on sort of the outside society intruding in, on sense of loss, on sense of purpose. Yet these all come together in a coherent whole, and that's even more impressive when there's no real narrative actually underpinning the film. It's almost like a sort of series of very brief vignettes over the course of a period of time, rather than actually conforming to a traditional structure. And I think it's great credit to Joanna Hogg that she manages to still make it feel coherent right the way through and still manages to bring out so many different interesting bits for you to play around with in your mind, and actually that there's such a contrast in tones and emotions through the course of the film.
Jack, I know it's been a few weeks since you saw the film down in London where it premiered. So you can't be as detailed as Mark was, but it's very much like a painting that's come to life or a piece of performance art in and of itself. There are certain scenes in the swimming pool they have in their house that resemble almost exactly David Hockney pictures, and it's just a wonderful example of what you can do with cinema that we don't get to see very much in even somewhere like the Arts Picture House.
Yeah, it reminded me the dynamic between the two artists in the film reminded me a bit of the dynamic between the two artists in Cutie and the Boxer. There's a moment where they're saying, I like you and I love you, you're my partner, but I feel you're stifling my artwork. And then it makes it interesting, there's a tension between the two. And you know they're unified, but there's also enough tension to make it dramatically exciting.
Do you think it should have done... Did you have a problem with the lack of narrative, because unlike her previous two films, Archipelago and Unrelated, this is much more constricted into one place, and it's much more... There's linear, but there's much less of a story. It's much more dreamlike. Did you find it gave you enough to cling on to with the characters?
Definitely. The characters and the setting. I mean, the house and the environment it's in mirrors their personalities. They live in this modernist 1960s house in the middle of a load of Victorian terraced London houses, and that kind of sums up their life attitude with their neighbours, as shown in a dinner scene perfectly. I thought it was great. It's open to interpretation. You're not being told what to see. It's left to your own devices.
I think the way in which it's constructed is that you gradually get more of a feel. There's barely two shots constructed from the same angle in the film, and so you gradually almost feel like you're learning the layout, learning the history of the house. But also, as the female character, I can't remember which initial is which. I think it's D.
D is the Velveteen, yes.
So as almost through her own sense of attachment to the house, you start to learn different facets of it, and you learn the character and the history of it and their relationship with it, and then by proxy you learn their relationship with each other and the way in which they're almost moving in different ways. It's just fascinating to see the different ways in which they interact, the fact that they spend more time talking on the phone in the same house than they actually do physically interacting. I think says a lot about modern relationships. But there is a real strong emotional core still, even though they're two what could be considered fairly eccentric characters in terms of sort of mainstream cinema. They, in particular, Dee, played by Viv, is... In sense of her performance artist role, almost childlike at times, yet that succeeds in never really alienating you. Actually, it's endearing, and consequently, actually helps to draw you more into what's happening.
And I think it works. A character like that works because, as you said earlier, there are so many levels to be found. I mean, it's a wonderful performance by somebody who's never acted before, certainly never in a feature film. But there are so it was fantastic seeing a film which. Features a sexual relationship. It's quite an erotic film in many scenes between characters who are in their late 50s or almost nearly in their 60s. I found that it reminded me a little bit, though the ages are younger, a little bit of All the Light in the Sky, the film we saw last year at the festival. But it's just fantastic to see characters like that on the screen.
Mm. Well, we do seem to be living in an era where actually we've reached a maturity in sexual relationships, you know, with Stranger by the Lake and Blue is the Warmest Colour and films like that we've had over the past sort of 6-7 months. Actually, it feels as if, almost as a culture, we've now been able to stop smirking every time we see sex on the cinema screen and actually sit and take it seriously, which is great.
And without giving too much away, there's the poster is very eye-catching and you think, oh, that looks nice, but you don't really know what's going on. And then... it's an amalgamation of two bits in the film, and the I've never done that with the stool myself, but it reminded me a bit of the start of Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac, where it flashes back to the young girl in her bathroom sliding around the place. And yeah, I thought it was a very interesting way of getting away with a kind of a raunchy shot on the poster advertising the film, while still making it look arty and highbrow.
And the house itself is a fascinating... It's all the interviews have said, the house is the third character in the film.
If it's up for sale, I'm trying to win the lottery to be in there, frankly. I loved it.
But it's not quite a... As they said, as their neighbours say, that they have dinner parties with when they can't escape them, it's not a house for a family as such, it's a house for two artists. It's a sort of betwixt and between house. You never actually see it from the outside properly. You never get an idea of it in context. But it's half a spaceship. It's got this amazing door that's like an airlock, where you have to lock one door and then before you get out the other. And it's in central London, but you get so you have all the again, she said in interviews, it's an inside house, and it's a story about an inside house or inside. It's I found that just. The way she presented the house, just fantastic, wonderful.
The one thing I'd like to comment on as well is the fantastic use of sound in the film. Just from scenes of walking down an alleyway towards the house to the increased atmosphere of some of the sounds outside the house, particularly at times when Dee's showing her nervousness because clearly something's happened previously which has disturbed her and she still has the attachment to the house but with certain reservations. And again, it all just helps to build the atmosphere, the emotion, and really emphasise her attachment to the house, and you know, it's given me an attachment to that house as well.
She is as in love with the house as she is with her husband, and I think that
possibly slightly more so.
Yes, I know. No, I think you expect the relationship in the film to go one way. You expect it to sort of collapse and dissolve in the way a soap opera would, but it doesn't. And in fact, it becomes not stronger, but it remains intrinsic. They remained intrinsically linked to each other all the way through the film. I thought that was again part of the maturity of it.
And you've got Tom Hiddleston doing the same role because he played a vampire in Only Lovers Left Alive, and he's an estate agent in this film.
He didn't need a change of clothing. No, he's just the same perfect. Character. Yeah. He's only in it a little bit. I noticed they didn't put him on the poster and hope to lure his fan base into the cinema for his two scenes as an estate agent or three scenes as an estate agent.
He's in the trailer, and I did think for a minute actually that was going to be all of him in the film, and he does get slightly more screen time than he did in Muppets Most Wanted, thankfully.
Is he in Muppets Most Wanted?
For about 4 seconds, yes.
Okay, all right.
He pierces the Great Escapo and then gets tasered by Tina Fey, spoiler. So yes,
was that a euphemism?
No, my brain doesn't quite think like that. But yes, don't go and see the film for Tom Hiddleston because I think he's just essentially a name on a poster. Do go and see the film for everything else about it. It's fantastic.
And the two central performances from Viv Albertine, used to be the guitarist in The Slits in the 1970s, and Liam Gillick, who is her husband in the film, who's D-H-H, it does get a bit confusing, was one of the Damien Hirst crowd, one of those young British artists, and both, especially Viv Albertine, but both of them are very, very good. And sometimes I have trouble with non-actor performances like the husband in Copy Certificate because it doesn't quite... It doesn't ring true. It doesn't have the weight that you need. But I didn't find that the case here at all.
I can think of one brief moment where it felt like two people acting rather than being natural. Other than that, and it was a very brief moment. Other than that, it felt completely naturalistic. It felt like two genuine people whose lives we were exploring.
Okay. All right. Well, the exhibition opened yesterday, April the 25th, and is currently screening at the Arts Picture House. It is Certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
As you may have heard over the past few days on Cambridge 105, we are broadcasting from a brand new Studio One, or rather the same studio outfitted with all new equipment, a stunning achievement by the station engineering crew over last weekend's Easter holiday. Now, we've got four desk mics, as well as this host mic, and a proper mixing desk in front of me. It makes a show like ours and Flavour and Arts Roundup sound wonderfully clear and much, much easier to produce. So a big thank you to Phil Rowe, Robert and Terry Chipperfield, Don Smith, Mark Turner, Mark Hickford and Tony Sayer for giving up their entire weekend on a volunteer basis as everything on the station is done.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Back in 1998 and the year 2000, Swedish director Lucas Moodysson seen the most optimistic man on the planet. His Show Me Love and its follow-up Together were humane and touching classics. Moodysson then made a surprising vault fast with Lilla Forever, Hole in My Heart and his US debut Mammoth, film so bleak it seems cinema was having a nervous breakdown. But Moodysson's latest film sees him throw a little sunlight back onto the screen with the rock and roll effervescence of We Are the Best. Set in the grey and watery Stockholm of the early 80s, the film, adapted by Moodysson from his wife's graphic novel, opens with Bobo and Clara, two 13-year-old girls who don't fit in. As the world dances to a disco beat, they're punk through and through, with the clothes, arguments and songs to match. The only trouble is they lack musical ability. But then they discover Hedvig, a sweet-natured girl whose Christianity has also set her apart from the rest of the school. After convincing her to cut her hair and sharpen her look, the three set out to change the world. Jack, coming to you because there's no trailer, because obviously it's in Swedish. In the past, Lucas Moodysson has had a knack for understanding the promises of young adulthood, in together especially with a group of young 20-somethings in a commune. Does We Are the Best show a similar grasp of the promises and perils and recklessness of youth?
Yes, and I found the film totally charming, and it reminded me a bit of the tagline of Matt Wolff's documentary Teenage that came out the end of last year, and that the tagline for that film, the concept was, teenagers did not always exist. And so it seems that in a lot of teenage films, part of the narrative drive is teenagers trying to justify their existence. And so maybe you've got a film like Gregory Curry's Mysterious Skin, where they're trying to justify their existence through their sexuality. Or you've got Sofia Coppola's The Bling Ring. They're trying to justify their existence through breaking into famous people's houses.
Mirroring the people they admire.
Yeah. And this one, it's punk. And they're told quite early on in the film, oh, don't you know? Oh, I'm not going to do the Swedish accent. Hang on.
No swearing, no slander, no accents at the beginning of the programme.
Don't you know punk is dead? And throughout the film, they're steadfast in their denial of this statement, and they go quite a long way to prove that punk is not dead in their world.
It's it would have been so easy, perhaps, for other filmmakers, because of the 1982 setting, that to make this a period piece, to feel, make it feel like a period piece. So there's a bit of a nostalgia. Son of Rambo, which is a film I like, but springs to mind as a film that sort of luxuriates in its setting. This, I didn't find that the case with this at all. It always feels like early 1980s, but it's much, much more alive than something set in amber.
I'll tell you why. It's the jumpers. Great jumpers, they feel really contemporary, don't they? And you look at them and think, God, they've got a good fashion taste, but it's back now, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of fashion. I really like Bobo's jumper, and she wore it all the time, which you do at that age. You have a favourite bit of clothing and you wear it all the time. And she's I think there's only two scenes when she's not in that jumper.
And the three girls are particularly tomboyish, androgynous, and their hairstyle, their look feels very contemporary as well. And it really warmed me to them. Whether you like a Mohican or a kind of Lady Gaga-esque, short at the front, long at the back kind of thing. Oh, no, that's a mullet. Whatever hairstyle you're into, they seem to have it catered for. And it's kind of funny to think that that's punk in the 80s, but now it's mainstream. I mean, not for us in the studio. None of us have hair like
Nobody
that.
Nobody knows. It's just
sorry.
Radio.
Yeah. But yeah, it really does feel quite contemporary and of the 80s as well. But maybe that's the difference between UK culture and Scandinavian.
Well, it's also because of how well Moodysson gets teenagers, how well he gets... There's not a moment in this film that doesn't feel authentic. And I don't know how, obviously, a certain amount of that is from the graphic novel that he's adapted, but he just gets how... This could easily go in Mark Cousins's film. They're a little bit older than the children he has in his recent documentary, A Story of Children and Film. But I think this sits alongside the films that he's been that are part of the season.
They're on the cusp, aren't they? 12 and 13.
Yeah, so they're just the 13. Moonrise Kingdom sort of age. Yeah. I found it fantastically believable in the different personalities, and that in that Clara's sort of mouthy, smart but mouthy, and she's constantly getting Bobo in trouble, and Bobo's pulling her back and is the voice of reason. The way they shout and scream about their parents, but they're perfectly acceptable when they're with them. Bobo's nice to her mother. It's also fascinating watching people rebel in 1980s Sweden, where there isn't that much to rebel against. They're fairly liberal. They are liberal families. How do you rebel when your mother and father are drinking and smoking in the next room and having parties of their own?
I guess you rebel against a musical genre and you go to the neighbouring town and you slag them off on stage.
But and then I found it, because a lot of the press obviously is focused on, as I've just done with the last question, with the teenage girls. I thought it was a fascinating insight into an examination of how rock and roll bands work. The ages became immaterial. They went through we only follow them for about 3 weeks while they're doing this one song that they've written. But the combination of those three characters, I think, would work for any band through the punk era, through progressive rock, any band from the time for the when they're starting up to when the bands reform and tour their golden oldies at the age of 60. I think the film gets the dynamics perfectly.
And I remember having to go to the cinema with my sister when we were kids, and I had to babysit her through Spice Girls the movie, And I just thought, oh, this is an astonishing waste of my time. What's going on? And it's a girl power, but you're just really aware that it's manufactured girl power. But these three girls in this film, it feels crisp and authentic.
But then it raises the interesting issue slightly when they're when the youth club where they practice, where Iron Fist, the heavy metal band, who are ridiculously misogynistic and well, ridiculously ridiculous, and when they're referred to, when our three heroines are referred to as a girl group, and they say, we're not a girl group. We're not, you know, we're just a band. We're not a girl group, and it does. They don't make a point of it. The film doesn't make a point of it, but it points out the problems that they're going to have if they do this, and which still exist today. There are groups like Sleater-Kinney and people who are constantly labelled under Riot Girl. And they think, well, no, stop. That's not the point.
Are they like younger versions of Courtney Love and Hole?
Yes,
they paved the way for Hole to appear in the late 80s, early 90s, maybe.
It's a fascinating film. I think this will be up there with one of the 10 best of the year, and I recommend everybody sees it, because it will enjoy a fair run, I think.
Definitely.
Word of mouth, I think, will
And you look at everyone coming out of the cinema and everyone's beaming. You go in not quite expecting to have such a good time, and even a moment's attention, you're kind of smiling because it's just really charming.
And you wouldn't want to form a group. You want to come out and do the Mickey Rooney thing of putting the show on right here. Yeah. That should be guitar lessons.
Hey,
straight
guys, let's form a girl band.
It's exactly like that. Anyway, okay, We Are the Best opened at the Arts Picture House yesterday, April the 25th, and it is a certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Just thinking, certificate 15 sort of alienates the exact audience that should really be watching it. But, yeah, sorry, I don't know. Okay, anyway, you are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 FM. I can go off on a tangent. I knew we were live. Community radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and I know what I'm doing with the mixing desk. And with me in the studio today are Steph Smith, Gavin Midgley, Mark Livesage, and Jack Toy. As always, don't forget there's a full afternoon of diverse programmes following us today on Cambridge 105. Saturday lunch is at 1 p.m, an hour of music and chat with Stuart Paske. He's on his own today. Then at 2 p.m, there's an all-new edition of Arts Roundup, the latest lowdown on what's occurring on the creative scene in the galleries, concert halls and theatres of Cambridge. Then Everything Italian from 3 p.m. with Radio Dante, and at 4 p.m. it's all the local, national and international sport with the 105 sport team. We've still got another 20 so minutes of the show to go. We'll wrap things up with The Amazing Spider-Man 2, but before that, it's time for Mirror Signal Maneuver.
Hi, love.
Love, I need you to hold it together for me.
What's happened?
I'll fix it. It'll all go back to normal.
No matter what the situation is, you can make it good.
This is a joke to you.
No. Right now, nothing is a joke anymore. You make one little mistake, eventually, cracks appear.
I'm not believing it.
I was 23 years old. I will do what needs to be done.
The deliberate setting of an entire film in one location is usually a challenge a bored veteran director gives themselves, Hitchcock with Rope and Lifeboat, or David Fincher with Panic Room, for instance. But writer-director Stephen Knight has opted for the technique with only a sophomore feature, with the entirety of new release Locke set inside the plush interior of a BMW. The driver of the car is Ivan Locke, played by an unusually mild-mannered Tom Hardy, a structural engineer and a site foreman whose life is about to turn upside down. The evening before a record-breaking concrete pour that will start a new build, Locke leaves his Birmingham building site. He takes a left turn where he would normally take a right and heads south to London rather than to his own home. Locke is a quiet and decent man, somebody who has always tried to do right by his family. But as he heads down the motorway at the dead of night, it becomes apparent a single sin of the past has finally caught up with him. Steph, Locke has been gathering up great reviews for Tom Hardy's performance, but does the film itself offer anything more than a gimmick?
It's a really well put together radio play. Tom Hardy's performance is great. And when the camera focuses on his face and you get the facial expressions as well, that works really well. Everything else visual in the film gets so repetitive. The cinematography is just cars, windscreens, out of focus, streetlights, and it just goes through that cycle of let's go on Tom Hardy's face, let's look at the dashboard, let's look at the road, And that, the visuals start getting boring. But Tom Hardy's performance was fantastic. It was that that made me want to see this film. On the description of the film, you know, one man in a car talking to camera and answering the phone does not sound like an exciting film. But because it was Tom Hardy, who is capable of giving a very good performance and seems to be very capable of picking very good roles, that definitely made me want to see it. So, yeah, it's a radio play with a few visuals. And as such, it works.
Gavin, you want to come in on this?
I think that's a bit harsh, actually. I mean, I found it... It's a very interesting screenplay in that it's almost Hitchcockian because it takes place in this sort of single location and it's sort of slowly unravels the story and you slowly find out what's going on behind it. But it's not really Hitchcockian because it's not about suspense. It's more of a sort of a human drama. But I really did get involved and I was surprised by how much I did get involved. What sort of slowly... Didn't quite work for me was this sort of stunt casting in a way. I mean, there's not stunt casting in the big name cameos doing the people at the other end of his phone, but they are slightly distracting and they are slightly disconnected from the rest of his performance. For me, anyway, it sort of brought me out of the piece a bit. But as a sort of 90-minute story, very cleverly set in a single location, and the screenplay is quite cleverly constructed, I thought it worked really well. Yeah, and Tom Hardy is very good in it.
Did anybody think that the concept of the invisible father, they need for him to have somebody bounce off? So like James Stewart talks to the fly, finds in his cab in The Spirit of St. Louis, Tom Hardy has his father who's the reason for his the way he is, who he sees in the rearview mirror, who obviously we don't see, but he addresses him. I felt that was a little bit, the drama was reaching there. I felt that was a little bit of a mistake. Jack, do you want to come? Because I know you've seen this.
I didn't have a problem with it. And maybe I can segue back to Her you mentioned earlier on, Gavin. With that film, because the voices, the disembodied voices, were supposed to be AI voices, I couldn't identify with them and I just didn't believe they were there. But with this film, because it was just people on the other end of the phone, it really worked. And then just having that one unseen character, it didn't.
But it did not feel like a Rolodex of famous people that the director. I mean, you've got Olivia Colman who's playing the lady that Tom Hardy's character's had an affair with. We've got Ruth Wilson. Is it Ruth Wilson who plays his wife, who's on the other line? Andrew Scott, who's Moriarty on Sherlock, who's his Irish co-worker. Back, everybody seeing, even Bill Milner as one of his sons. Everybody was somebody. And it began to feel a little bit like it was... Well, I can see they wanted the best voices for the role, but it just began to feel a little bit artificial.
Well, it was less... Well, take a film like Carnage, the film adaptation of it, based on a stage play. So you've got four big names in that, and they're on screen most of the time, and they're trapped within the confines of this apartment. The furthest they get out of the room is the lift door, and then they come back in again. Well, this is a more stripped-down version of that, because you still have the big names there, but... You're just in this BMW in the cab, and I think it works quite well. Otherwise, it would have been a lot worse if they were all in the car with him, or in the passenger just shouting.
That would have felt rather contrived. I thought the voices just coming back were quite good, and I thought the idea of talking to his father, it didn't feel too contrived because it allowed him to monologue without actually feeling like a stage play. Because he is actually thinking about his father, he's talking to his father, he's imagining what he would say to his father if they could talk face to face. So I think it's just kind of a way of bringing in a monologue while still trying to feel like a film. I think that's what it was struggling to do all the way through.
Yeah, it also gave a break from the phone calls, which, you know, they became quite incessant after a while, which is a good thing because it did help build suspense, because every time the phone rang, you think, OK, what's going to happen now? But at the same time, I think Toby's right, the sort of father device is a bit hackneyed, a bit sort of contrived in that it gives him a pass, but it's just a bit too obvious.
It sometimes felt like, you know, it is, as impressively written as the film is, and I enjoyed the film for what it was, but it just occasionally felt like it was scriptwriting 101. There was a big book on how to write scripts in closed spaces, and it was touching all of those points. And I found in the end, I found that the metaphors the film was raising too heavy-handed. This idea that he was a concrete, he poured concrete for a living. He was a foreman in jobs that did that, and that his wife says, "Oh, you just leave footprints of stone on the kitchen floor and the metaphors of cracks in the buildings for the relationship, I found that all rather heavy-handed. And as someone who finds myself on Radio 4 at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, where these dramas are to a penny, and they're always good, it reminded me of that. It had that heavy-handed nature of a Radio 4 mid-afternoon drama.
Well, that was my feel of it. It felt like that kind of radio play, and it felt like as if somebody was just trying to get a bigger audience by making a film out of it, because I didn't think the visuals justified it being a film, but I thought it was an interesting enough radio play that I was very happy to go to the cinema and listen to it and maybe just, you know, watch what's happening on screen, even though it didn't add much to what I thought was an excellently written play.
I'm not sure how they'd have introduced the backstory with his, you know, he says his the locks of yesteryear were all rather unreliable and they walked away from their problems, and that's part of the tension of him driving to confront his problem or his issue.
But they've raised, but they've made that problem for themselves, sounds like I'm dismissing the film, which I enjoyed, and I think it's well worth seeing, but it raises a lot of problems in its own construction, which I then think it paints itself into a corner, and I'm not quite sure how the way it gets out of that is the best way possible. I think that's my problem, is that you're right, he's, I suppose in the end it goes down to the fact I didn't like the idea of him talking to his father. It didn't seem to come from the Ivan Locke we had in the rest of the film. It felt like a separate character. It didn't feel genuine.
He's a bit feverish, though, isn't he? You're unsure whether all of that Calpol or whatever it is he's swigging is making him get a bit hallucinatory the wheel. And then you think, is he going to crash? Is he just? Does he do this when he's pouring concrete, just start talking to people? So he presents one instance of him being steadfast and reliable, and then in the other instance he's talking to the rear passenger seat.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of it feels logical. It feels like it makes sense. But it's only when you start to look at it analytically that you start to question, how does this hang together? It actually feels quite academic. You know, as you said, it feels like a bit like a sort of a lecturer deliberate writing a screenplay on how to develop a character. Quite an actorly piece as well. You wonder how much input Tom Hardy perhaps had into this project, how much he wanted to be able to do from sitting in a car seat for 90 minutes. You know, there's only so many phone calls you can take. It felt like he was wanting to give his character greater depth, and perhaps this was the only way to do it from a car seat.
Yeah. Well, this is, it sounds like, again, I've made it sound like we're all dismissing it. We're not at all. It is a very, very good film.
It is good. I think it looks good as well, you know, despite the fact that it is in this.
I think it looks as good as you could expect, yes. I think it distracts a little bit from Tom Hardy's performance because the direction can be a little bit gimmicky.
But it gives it a bit of a noir feel to it as well, actually.
That's true. But again, that's a bit of a red herring, I think. So I might prefer somebody else directing it from the same script, and we might have got a little bit, made it look a little bit less like a car commercial. Anyway.
Finally, the M6 is immortalised on screen.
Is it the M6? I was trying to Google which road it was yesterday.
Newcastle to London. One of my favourite motorways.
M6 onto the M1.
So. Okay. Right, okay.
Exciting facts.
I've driven those roads far too often.
I've broken my vow of never reviewing a film about the M6. Okay, Locke opened last week and is showing at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 15. I think it's also on at Cineworld. Even by the cynical standards of Hollywood, the reboot of Spider-Man in 2012, a mere 5 years since the hugely successful Sam Raimi trilogy, was a desperate move, made simply to keep a profitable character out of the hands of another studio. Whilst the resulting film, directed by Mark Webb and starring Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker and Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy, managed to cover over old ground with a breezy charm, it never really escaped the sense of cash-grabbing déjà vu. The sequel, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, picks up with its hero in full swing. New York has grown fond of its masked man, whilst away from the costume, Peter Parker is still madly in love with Gwen Stacy. But despite his acrobatics, Parker is a troubled soul, haunted by the mystery of his missing parents and troubled by his promise to Gwen's dying father that he wouldn't let her become the target for his enemies. And new enemies are on the horizon, over at science company Oscorp, where Jamie Foxx's mild-mannered engineer Max Dillon suffers a sort of industrial accident that can only lead to supervillainy.
You know what it is I love about being Spider-Man? Everything.
Peter, you're gonna want to see this.
Oscorp.
He had you under surveillance.
Why?
Isn't that the question of the day?
Nothing is what I thought it was.
I once told you that secrets have a cost. The truth does too.
My name is Richard Parker. I have discovered what Oscorp was going to use my research for.
You wanted to be the hero.
Need a hand?
Now you gotta pay the price.
We have the power now. We can change the world.
Then let's go catch a spider.
Mark, the filmmakers themselves admitted the rebooted Spider-Man a few years ago lacked a bit of oomph, an error they've tried to correct with this much more stuffed sequel. Did they produce a better film?
Not really.
Let's keep it short. Let's move on.
I think there's two sides to this. The first side is the oomph, the action sequences. They were a bit lacklustre in the original amazing, in air quotes, Spider-Man. They are improved here. There's more of a clarity. I didn't see it in 3D, but I would imagine it would have worked better in 3D because of the way in which the shots were structured and the shot length. The converse of that is the character development itself. It feels like it's treading water for most of the film. There's a huge chunk in the middle when the main villain just disappears, so Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone can have a big debate about whether or not she's going to Oxford. It's not exactly the stuff that blockbusters are made of. So while it improves on one hand, it from a character and a plot development point of view, it then gets worse on the other. And without trying to spoil it, I was slightly sickened by the ending.
Gavin, I think that's part of the problem is that the film is good intentions aside, maybe from Mark Webber, the director, and some sterling work from Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone. This just feels like a preamble for the third film, really. It doesn't feel like a full film in and of itself.
Yeah, you get the sense that they're trying to open out this universe into their own equivalent of the Marvel Cinematic Universe so that they can set up spin-offs and sequels and sidequels and who knows what else. So there's a surfeit of villains to choose from. To be fair, it's actually handled reasonably well. You got a couple of villains who clearly are going to develop into further sequels, but and the main villain gets a reasonable amount of screen time as a result. But there isn't the action is fairly spotty. Sometimes it's interesting. Sometimes it's
none of it sticks. I can't remember much besides other the opening truck chase in the film.
That was my main problem with it. It's nothing about it is particularly memorable. You go in. I actually enjoyed it while I was watching it. I think I was having fun, and I was enjoying what I was seeing on screen. The chemistry between Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone is very good, which meant that the sort of soap opera element to their relationship kept me engaged through, in between sort of action scenes. So I quite enjoyed that aspect of it. It only falls flat when it goes all CGI and it gets a bit hysterical with some of these supporting characters. And afterwards you just go, I went left the cinema and I thought, yeah, I don't remember it. Was it good? I can't remember. It's so manufactured. It's very sort of artificial. It feels like they sort of churned it out on a factory belt and we wait for the next one.
There's two quick comparisons I'd like to make. The first is the fact it's unfortunate it's come out so close to Captain America 2, which the Marvel films now are doing a very good job of expanding the universe but also expanding their characterizations. It felt like Captain America 2 made Captain America more relevant. It had a clear idea of wanting to take it plot-wise, and then it built good action sequences around it. The comparison for me really here feels like Iron Man 2, which was just Iron Man with a few extra characters spun in, which didn't develop anything at all. So Marvel themselves have learnt the lesson from that. Given that we've got a Sinister Six spin-off planned, given that there's two more Spider-Man films already in train, given that they're Fantastic Four and there's an intent to try and weave them in because those are the two Sony properties left, they have got to learn that same lesson and quickly if these films are going to have some worth to them.
I think Fox owned Fantastic Four. I don't think... Do Sony own Fantastic Four? Anyway, this is a silly argument. I don't care who owns what.
There has been a debate about... Fantastic Four and Spider-Man ending up in the same film because then you've got the X-Men universe elsewhere.
Are my eyes glazing over? It's not you, Mark.
There is a sense of redundancy here, though. We've been here. We've done the Spider-Man films, and there's nothing in these new ones that really better the old ones, I don't think. Even in terms of the performances.
It does feel like a continued apology for Spider-Man 3, which wasn't that bad when all said and done.
No.
I think also the sense of we've now got to character development and superhero, supervillain creation, more crucially, by shorthand. They're talking about the Sinister Six. There are two of the costumes for the main potential villains of that in glass cabinets at the back when one of the villains in here is being created, which feels like somebody's just going to turn up and walk into that costume in the next film with no development. It's engineering itself more towards being purely about the battles. While that might be lovely for teenage boys who get their kicks from big action sequences, as I was once upon a time, I've matured now and I expect something slightly more from my blockbusters. I didn't get it here.
Steph, you have 30 seconds to add your 2 cents. What audience is this for? It's not kids.
It's the lowest common denominator. It's summed up by the fact that Gwen Stacy justifies her existence in a dangerous set by saying, I know how to turn this off. And then there's a big sign when she walks into the room that has something equivalent of off switch. It's a deactivation unit or something. It's kind of a trained monkey could have done that. It's kind of, it doesn't use its cast. It doesn't force the audience to use their brains. It's willfully simplistic and lowest common denominator, but shiny and fun.
Okay, shiny and fun it is. Well, I'd argue on the fun bit. Okay, it's shiny. The Amazing Spider-Man 2 opened last week and is shining at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is available in either 2D or 3D. Anybody see 3D? Mark, you didn't?
No.
No, 3D is supposed to be rather good, but I avoided it by habit. And it is a certificate 12A. That is all we have time for on the show today. The whole sad ordeal will be available. I should really rewrite my first draft, shouldn't I? When I'm in a more positive mood. We'll be online soon as a Cambridge 105 podcast, available to download from www.cambridge105.fm, and as a subscribable recording via the Bums on Seats iTunes page. And don't forget, we are on both Facebook and Twitter. Simply search for Bums on Seats and we'll obediently turn up. We'll be back on the 10th of May with the reviews of Blue Ruin, Neighbours, Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne versus the guy from Thingy Bob, can't remember his name. Zac Efron, thank you. Plus, we've got Michael Fassbender and a papier-mâché head with Frank, and the magic realistic animated biography of The Wind Rises, the swan song of master filmmaker Hayao Miyazaki. We'll round up the show with some of Trevor Jones' score from Jim Henson's puppet fantasy Dark Crystal, an oddity now as it was when it was originally released in 1982, and enjoying a 70mm screening tomorrow at the Arts Picture House from 6 o'clock, I believe. 6:30. Please stay tuned from Saturday Lunch, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.